Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, this is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
Hello, this is Rose Mercier in Kingston, Ontario, Canada, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello, everybody. Thank you, Rose, for introducing this edition of the Tennis Podcast. Catherine and Matt and myself, David Law, are here to answer your questions today because it's Thursday. We wanted a podcast. We've only answered about five or six in every other previous listener questions podcast, so we've still got loads and loads to get through. Plus, about another 150 came in with Matt just putting out a single tweet. So how are you doing both? Matt, you all right?
Fine, thank you. Yes, busy wading through all those questions, but that has been completed and we are ready to get going.
Ready to rock, and we'll have to rock because one of them's about entrance music, Catherine, for us to come into. Can't wait for that one.
No spoilers.
How are you today? All right?
I'm all right. I've popped a cardigan over my dressing gown to try and disguise the fact that I am not dressed, but I'm looking at myself in the camera and I'm realizing it's a flimsy disguise, isn't it?
Fooled me.
Did it? Oh, okay. I needn't have mentioned anything.
28 seconds ago, I thought
Catherine's pre-midday, dressed up for this. So, you know, lockdown and everything.
Okay, so a little insight there, folks. Stuff we didn't even know. We both thought Catherine had dressed up for the occasion, but apparently not.
This is our earliest record of lockdown, I think.
It is. It's a bit early, isn't it? Crikey, yeah. It's 10:30 in the morning, folks. That doesn't exist on Catherine's clock. She's had to borrow one. Right, questions. We are going to get cracking immediately. Matt, what have we got?
First up, we're going to Shari B., on Instagram, who asks, probably in response to our pod on Monday when we touched on this topic, how can we make tennis more enjoyable without an audience?
Oh, that is a big ask, isn't it?
It's probably something we should all be thinking about, though, isn't it? Rather than, I mean, you know, we said on the last pod that we all have our reservations about tennis behind closed doors without a crowd, whatever you want to call it. But it's a very real prospect. I've done a couple of interviews in the last couple of days, one with Sergi Bruguera, one with Michael Chang. You'll be hearing bits of them over the coming weeks. And we touched on lots of topics, but I asked them both how they felt about tennis behind closed doors. And their opinions could not have been more polarized. Sergi said, yep, I'm absolutely all for it. Just bring tennis back as soon as possible. No matter what you have to do, just bring it back. He sounded almost panicked. He said, bring football back, bring tennis back. I need to watch Barcelona as a matter of urgency. I need tennis to return. And, you know, when he first answered the question, he was definitely talking about it from a spectator's perspective. And I said, what about as a player though? Would it imagine playing a French Open final with no crowds? And still he said, I don't care. Just bring it back. I put the same question to Michael Chang and he said the opposite. He said, no, I just can't envisage it. It's too weird. I can't really get my head around it. So there is going to be a massive divide in the tennis community if and when the first actual, you know, tour level event gets announced that it's going ahead. You know, there's going to be a lot of debate flying around. So we're getting in there early. I wondered if I covered a Champions Tour event in, I think, 2008 in Istanbul in July. It was my first one flying solo. And Istanbul in July, it was about 45 degrees. I'm not sure why they decided that was where it should be in the calendar. But anyway, it was too hot to be outside, let alone sit for a prolonged period watching sports. So there was just nobody in the crowd, nobody whatsoever. So they pumped crowd noise in. And it was weird. Of course it was weird, but maybe it helped a little bit. I don't know. It's like watching, they've been doing the Graham Norton show, haven't they, with him from his house with a little sort of mini studio set up, and he still does his little comedy bits in between guests, and what he's saying is funny, and he's still the same guy, he's still as charming and funny as ever, but hearing those jokes land without any crowd response is really, really painful. It puts a completely different complexion on it. And I'm sort of finding myself, I can't believe I'm saying this, because I've spent 15 years talking about how canned laughter was the only bad thing about I'm Alan Partridge. But it makes me sort of cry out for some canned laughter. I don't know. What is this pandemic doing to me?
So this is going to be like sport office style, isn't it? Where great things happen to utter silence, and that's going to be a bit jarring. Or I think there's two things. One, I think it'll be interesting to see whether we adjust as viewers. It is a different world. Let's assume it's a different world for a long time, and we just have to kind of get used to it, and we can't do what we used to do anymore. John McEnroe used to fly on a Concorde to London every so often. He can't do that anymore. He has to go on another plane.
Oh, yeah, that's the same.
No, I know, but, you know, there are certain things that die out or
John,
you can't
John's
do anymore.
Struggle is real.
But, I mean, you know, it is still only sport, isn't it? So maybe you just adjust
come on.
For the love of the game.
You can't flippantly say at a time when, you know, we've all discussed and given heartfelt accounts of why it's not just sport. Come on. You can't flippantly say.
I wonder whether we'll find something else within the sport other than just the sound. I don't know. I'm wondering whether I will watch the sport in a different way.
I think your other senses will become more attuned.
Yeah, possibly. I may fall out of love with it. That's also possible.
I think ultimately the fact that it isn't just sport is actually the strongest argument to bring it back without fans, because it's what players need for their livelihood. So if there's a way to get the tour back up and running, get the economics of it back up and running without fans, that is going to be more important, I think, than the consideration of whether fans are in the stadium or not. If we're going to be able to give these players a chance to play with prize money and all that kind of thing, then they need to take that opportunity. It's going to be weird, but we're going to have to accept that. I think that's a more important consideration than whether it's a bit weird or not for fans.
But they are, those two things are intertwined, aren't they? Because the economics of it, a big chunk of that,
are very dependent on fans.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And TV broadcast interest.
Sure.
And all the rest of it. I do think it will perhaps be slightly more viable, less weird at indoor events where you're able to black out the seats. I mean, that visual of empty seats, I think, at events which are poorly attended, that always doesn't feel right. It always kind of takes you out of the moment a little bit. So I think there's a bit of an advantage maybe for indoor events in that regard. You can sort of create a bit of atmos with lighting. Am I clutching? I don't know.
I mean, that's the thing. We've all seen and been to tennis events which have been poorly attended. Like, I'm sure we've all sat on a court where there was probably only 10 or 12 of us in the stadium, and it's felt weird and felt like, oh, I don't want to watch this really. But you get through it. I think the problem...
we will endure.
Well, exactly. I think it's going to be something we have to just put up with, kind of. I think
you do adjust. I've commentated on it.
I think the problem is, we talked about on Monday, I can't imagine slams without fans. I think once you get to such a high level, it becomes more difficult. But those are the events which are going to provide players with more opportunities
exactly.
to play.
Exactly. Those are the ones that are most likely to go ahead. Maybe not in the first instance. I assume they'll sort of try it at a low level for sort of guinea pig purposes. But if the argument is you just need to get tennis back up and running to quote our fearless leader, get the economy moving, get the tennis economy moving, then, you know, the stakes are highest for that at slams. There's the biggest payoff at the slams. It is so hard to imagine a Grand Slam final with no crowd.
I think there's a couple of things, though. One is a little like how I feel we're adjusting to life at the moment with slightly different expectations of it and appreciating simpler things. Not going out, not spending money, but I'm more easily pleased by not very much, quite honestly. And I wonder whether that may be how the viewing public looks at this. Is if you've kind of lost everything, if you get some of it back, just that little chance to enjoy it again, okay, well, that'll do. You know, I'm all right with that. One of the other questions we did have, I don't think it's on our list, but is whether those sort of tournaments would have an asterisk next to them for the winner. I mean, for me, as long as everybody can play, I think it is what it is. But the other one is, I just feel like it'll be interesting to see what tournaments do to try to combat this weirdness, because some of the tournament promoters are really innovative and have got great imaginations for how to make something a great viewing experience. And I can't think, in this age when you think of the special effects that you can get in films and in games and all these sort of things. Now, again, it would take a bit of a mind adjustment from us as a viewers, but maybe they can come up with something, maybe even interactive on the screen, that could transmit what you're feeling as a viewer on TV onto what's in the stadium.
A hologram crowd, like you have hologram Prince concerts.
Yeah, maybe you could press a button 1 to 10 about how excited you are.
At the Australian Open a couple of years ago, in the sponsor village, one of the banking sponsors, ANZ, had this like indoor booth thing where you could go in and play air guitar with a hologram of country singer Keith Urban. And it was... it was the single weirdest thing I've ever seen, I think. And Novak Djokovic was sponsored by ANZ at the time. And it was when I was working for Tennis Australia and had to troop down there to film him air guitaring with country singer Keith Urban. Not the real one, a hologram. Holograms are weird, is my conclusion.
Virtual reality. I don't know. Maybe there's something out there that can be done. We will find out.
Would you have music at the change of ends? Would you have Sweet Caroline playing at the change of ends if there's nobody to sway and sing along with it?
Yeah, I'd have a brilliant piss-taking DJ who just made fun of the whole situation.
What would you have? Nobody speak? You could create a whole playlist.
Exactly.
She's not there. Oh, I found my vibe.
What about headset coaching every change of ends?
Ooh, that's great.
Or does that delegitimize it as an event?
No, I like that.
Yeah, but we like the idea of headset coaching anyway.
I don't particularly.
But as David says, it's going to call for some massive innovation. Mm. And actually, that's not that massive innovation, because it has been seen, and there is a sort of precedent for it.
It will be interesting to see what happens if the Australian Open manages to run the tournament and if for some reason they couldn't have fans, how they did it, because they are seriously innovative, aren't they? But I also think that they might be able to make it work with an amount of fans anyway. We'll see. Matt, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say that Catherine's story about pumping crowd noise into the stadium always reminds me of the conspiracy theory that at the golf, at the Masters, they play bird noises over the, like on the TV broadcast to make it sound more sort of at one with nature than it actually is. Like when you're on the ground necessarily at the Masters, you can't necessarily hear all those noises, but when you're watching it on the TV, they sort of play them in and make it sound sort of magical and
that's
entice you to go.
That's a terrible scandal. That's like...
I don't know whether that's been proved
it's like
to be
the
true
smell
or not.
Of Subway being fake. They pump out a manufactured smell of sandwiches.
People always tell you to brew coffee when you're selling your house. Apparently that gets people going.
Coffee and bread, I think.
Bread, yeah.
Is it? And... finally, we found a use for that awful goal music when someone scores a goal. And rather than hearing the crowd, you hear some rubbish music played way too loud so that you can't hear the crowd.
Yeah, shame on QPR. They do that. Any chance to take a dig?
Dancing on my own. I'm riffing now.
What sort of DJ music do you want played to sum up the situation? That's your challenge at Tennis Podcast. Let us know. Catherine will be thinking about that for the remainder of the day.
Just the two of us?
That's a good one. Right, we've had 18 minutes on that. Matt, have we got time for another question?
Sticking with topical questions before we dive into some other ones... we've had a lot of questions about Ines Ebu's response to Dominic Thiem's comments about not wanting to be part of the scheme to give his prize money, his money to lower-ranked tennis players. This is Ines Ebu, the Algerian player who produced a video. It was advertised as like an open letter to Dominic Thiem as a response, but in the style of a video. And our reaction to that basically is what people want to know.
Well, first of all, it was brilliantly produced. Well done, her and whoever put that together with her. It was very powerful, very slick, and it got the message across that her circumstances are very different to maybe those that Dominic Thiem started his career with, and that many players of his situation may have found themselves in when they were trying to make their way in terms of the resources available to them, the kind of courts that they can play on, the facilities they might have to use, and the ability to travel around the world. And she was making the point very powerfully, impressively, I thought, about the trials and tribulations of somebody in her situation and what the coronavirus and the lack of tennis as a result means to her. My immediate reaction was, I feel a bit sorry for him that because he's put his name out there and his comments out there, he has been jumped on. We talk about this a lot, how you can end up being shamed. And this certainly does amplify that. It gives people who may not have the best interests of everybody at heart a cause to jump on and use as a reason to bash him. But at the same time, I thought it was really important that she, as somebody ranked, I think, 600 in the world, had an opportunity, gave herself a platform to get her point across, and it was seen and it was heard. And I have to say, it was a standpoint that whilst we heard from Sofia Shapotova on our What Happens When Tennis Stops interview, we heard something about that. I felt that this did a really good job of getting the point across that not everybody's situation is the same, and you can't just judge every player with your own experience, your own upbringing. And I think it served a valuable purpose in that way. It was a great conversation starter. What did you think, Catherine?
Yeah, I'm very similar to what you think. I mean, I understand why people are quite comfortable with the the personal attack on Dominic Thiem in the video, and how sort of accusatory and combative it is, you know, referencing him so often specifically. But maybe we wouldn't be talking about it. Maybe it wouldn't have created the waves that it has had she not done that, because, you know, his comments obviously created the waves because of the platform that he has, and she doesn't have that. So to grab people's attention, she's had to do something a bit shocking, really. And I would also say that she probably felt like Dominic Thiem's comments about lower ranked players, I suspect that they felt extremely personal to her, even though she wasn't named. I suspect that that felt like a personal attack. So kind of a tit for tat thing. I think whether you agree with the wider point about higher ranked, wealthier players supporting lower ranked players, that's kind of taken separately, I take it separately to the point she makes about just tennis and the world, frankly, should be trying to have a greater appreciation of privilege and the way the playing field is very, very far from level. That's what I do think there is something in what Dominic Thiem had to say. I think I can sympathise with his point that he resents the obligation to support lower ranked players. But I think that doesn't necessarily go hand in hand with his dismissiveness of the effort and the opportunity that that lower ranked players have and have had. So I think drawing attention to privilege in the sport and in the world is a very, very good thing, and she makes that point extremely well, I think. And although I don't think it invalidates everything that Dominic Thiem had to say, and I do feel some sympathy for him that he's become the poster boy for not wanting to support lower ranked players, maybe he and others have learned a bit of a lesson of privilege, and not to throw comments around without considering your own experience and how that colours your feelings about things.
Matt, what do you think when you heard the comments from Dominic, when you saw the video? What was your response?
I actually think, aside from the fact that it made such good points about Dominic Thiem's privilege, I think the most important aspect for tennis is that, as you said, it should be a conversation starter, because tennis for a long time has wondered about how many players should be professional, how many players should be making a living, what it even means to be professional. Is it to be playing the sport? Is it to be making a living? Those sorts of existential questions have been around in tennis for a long time. And I actually think Thiem's comments and Ibu's video have really brought that conversation to the fore. And I think that could be one of the positives that comes out of our current situation, and also these sorts of discussions being had. So I think I slightly also took issue with the targeting of Thiem and the way Thiem has become, as you said, that kind of symbol of top ranked players looking dismissively on lower ranked players. I think it's slightly complicated by the fact that Thiem has a brother who is a lower ranked player. But ultimately, I think it's important that these people are allowed to give their views without being attacked on either side. I think Thiem's been attacked. I think Ibu has probably been attacked as well for making that video, and I don't think that's helpful. I think they're both really good conversation starters that will actually lead us to a better place.
We had another question, didn't we, in a similar vein, inspired by, you know, the Thiem comments in the Ibu video, about a sort of guaranteed minimum level income for lower ranked players. Obviously, sort of the structure and the details of that would be incredibly complicated, but the idea of the idea of universal basic income is very interesting anyway, and being discussed now more and more because of what's going on in the world. But that is quite interesting, isn't it? The idea of UBI in tennis. And it does lead me back to Liam Brody's comments about match fixing. And that's kind of the underbelly of this whole thing that's rarely discussed. The two issues are very, very related. It would remove a lot of the incentive for match fixing, and I think go some way to solve that problem. I'm opening a massive can of worms with the UBI thing, but I do find it interesting.
And I think so often the way that tennis is structured in terms of prize money is labelled as a good thing, because ultimately if you're able to make it to the top, you get what you deserve and all that kind of thing. But that does ignore the fact that Ibu is making that it's so much harder to get to the top if you're from a country that isn't as wealthy as others. So a basic income would potentially allow those players more of a chance to get on an equal playing field in terms of being able to earn what they deserve for how good they are at tennis.
Just filtering that money down so that when you do achieve at those lower ranked tournaments that you get something more for it that you can build with. There is more incentive then to achieve at that level. But actually, just generally, those two questions combined and the answers that we've all come up with point to me towards what this period can do for the world and for tennis generally, is just stop us in our tracks for a minute and have to consider a different way of being, because people can't be bothered to think like that otherwise, because they don't need to most of the time. And there will be a lot of people suffering right now and a lot of people suffering in the future, and I feel for them. But I also feel that some good can come from all of this when we eventually get back to some sort of normal that we're happy with. I think there could be some improvements as a result of it. If not, then it's an even bigger disaster. So what else we got?
Simon Kevin on Twitter asks, if you had the power to change any result in history, one men's and one women's match, which one would you choose?
David's going to go for something from the 90s.
Obviously.
I've got my women's one. Somebody else can
Far
do men's
away.
If you want. I would go back and change two of the Grand Slam finals that Margaret Court won. So she doesn't have 24, she's got 22. Serena Williams has already broken a record, and we don't have to talk about Serena Williams breaking Margaret Court's record anymore. And we hopefully don't have to talk about Margaret Court as much as we do anymore. So I would take away probably a couple of her Australian Opens where she only beat Australian players. I don't want to do, you know, she was a great, great tennis player. I'm not being dismissive of her achievements, but I think just the binary use of numbers ignores the fact that the achievements aren't equivalent. You know, the Australian Open wasn't what it is now. It didn't require the same greatness to win some of those Australian Open titles that are counted among the 24. So I would ditch a couple of those and just end that discussion now.
Can I have two men's matches?
Yeah.
I feel a bit bad for this. I'm going to go. Well, I mean, I might have a women's. I'm going to have a women's match as well, but I can't choose between the two men's matches that are out of the two.
I was going to make a flippant comment about sexism there, but given that I've already accused you of mansplaining today, I moonwalked away from it quickly.
Also, pick your target. Of all the people,
no one's beyond reproach, David.
No, all right.
Yes, if anyone's sensing any tension across the airwaves.
We nearly didn't get on air today, folks. So I look at this as a massive triumph. Right, so I'm having Andy Roddick finally winning a Wimbledon title, and I think we should be giving him 2009. And that's not to say that Federer didn't earn it. Ultimately, he did. He won it 16-14 in the fifth, but to feel that Andy Roddick didn't deserve that or didn't deserve one of those feels harsh to me.
That means Federer's on 19, same as Nadal.
Yeah. I think he can afford to be on 19 and Roddick to be a Wimbledon champion.
Can I make a counterclaim?
Try.
I agree. I would love Andy Roddick to have a Wimbledon title, but the fact that that was the match which was the record breaker for the Slams, I think, was perfect. I think if Federer hadn't won that, he'd have broken it. If he kept on winning the Slams, he did win. He'd have broken it in the 2010 Australian Open final, a straight sets defeat of Andy Murray, a fairly non-memorable match. I think for such a big moment in tennis history, the all-time men's slam record being broken, the fact that it was 16-14 in the fifth was kind of perfect.
Yeah, he wouldn't have been able to wear that jacket in the Australian Open.
Exactly.
Men's.
And anyway, Andy,
final.
I mean, you know, I know exactly how you feel because I've lost a Wimbledon final heartbreakingly as well last year, said Roger.
And I wonder where you were going with that.
Yeah,
it's exactly the same thing.
If you had an out of body experience, David.
And my second one is for Tim Henman to have beaten Guillermo Coria.
That was mine.
Semi. Because, and nothing against Guillermo Coria, fair play, won the match fair and square. But wouldn't it have been fascinating to see what would have happened with Tim Henman? Tim Henman in the French Open final against Gaston Gaudio. Wouldn't that have been amazing? Would he have won it? What do you think? What do you think? Do you think he'd have won it if he'd have got through?
He'd have had a good chance. I mean, that French Open final was so weird in so many ways. He'd have had a really, really good chance. Remember that match he played against Chaler that year, and he was just brilliant. I loved seeing Henman at the French Open that year. I mean, Henman that year, 2004, was just a great watch all over, wasn't he? I think three of the four semi-finals. He was well and truly in his pomp, but I loved seeing him do what he did on clay.
I've always wondered if Tim Henman had won any slam, really, how different do you think the start of Andy Murray's career would have been in terms of, obviously, Murray lost, what was it, three slam finals to begin with. Do you think that was a internal pressure? I mean, okay, he came up against Federer and Djokovic playing brilliantly in those finals. He might not have made any difference. Or do you think the sort of external pressure of being a Brit and carrying all that weight on his shoulders actually did harm him in the start of his career? I don't know. I mean, it's an impossible question, but I've often wondered that.
I think he'd have had a harder time coming up with a logo. Well, it's the 77, isn't it?
Yes. I was thinking it was AM.
Since. Is there anything you can do with 10? Or is the argument? So, I don't know. I'm wondering whether maybe early on in his career, maybe it might have been easier for him. But I don't know. I don't think it would have made much difference.
No,
really, I think
probably not.
Murray's just a dog with a bone who just keeps on coming, and you can't change him. I don't think so. I think he would have just probably dealt with it all the same. I was thinking maybe. Might have given. Did Arantxa Sánchez Vicario ever win Wimbledon? I don't think she did.
No.
I think maybe she warranted a Wimbledon
title.
What
about Lendl winning Wimbledon?
Oh, Lendl.
Sampras winning the French?
No, he didn't deserve it. Much as I love. No, he didn't. I love Sampras. And in 96, he beat Courier, Bruguera, two of the great former champions to get to the semis. But, you know. And he had a tough time that year. I felt for him that year because his coach had just died. And he ran out of gas. He lost to Kafelnikov in the semifinals. But he did only get to one semifinal of the French Open in more than a decade of his career. And that's not great, really. You know, Boris Becker did better than that. So, I don't know. I don't think he deserved it.
I think.
Much as I loved him.
I think if the world ends with Andy Murray not having an Australian Open, that'll be a weird thing. Which it probably will.
I mean, in terms of the French, I think people like McEnroe deserved it more. He got to that final and he so nearly won in 84.
I wasn't arguing for Sampras. I just thought you might, because I know what a big fan of Sampras you are, I thought you might have a bit of sentimental Sampras bias.
Doesn't deserve it.
No, just well, doesn't deserve it.
There's a little bit of residual anger from my 90s experience, because I was so desperate for him to do it as a fan before I started working in tennis. And I felt as though he didn't apply himself enough on clay. For a few years, I felt it was a bit of a token effort, and I mean, he may completely disagree with that, but that's how I felt at the time. So, you know, I don't really feel like he was unjustly dealt with in the end. Yeah, Arantxa Sánchez Vicario, when you look at her head-to-head with Graf, there were so many great matches, so many close matches, and she nearly got over the line once or twice. So I thought maybe she warranted one. But I tend to feel like, generally, I'd rather go for somebody who wasn't a Grand Slam champion who had a moment. So, you know, maybe Henman is why I'm going for him on the clay.
I would go for Venus Williams in the 2017 season. Either the Wimbledon final or the US Open semi-final against Stevens, which she lost. I think that season deserved a slam. I think it deserved that exclamation point on it.
And if it had one, it would go down as one of the all-time greats.
Absolutely.
Which it still deserves to be considered, but isn't, because it doesn't have that.
And I think Venus gets slightly forgotten about in terms of how great she was. We've done a lot of this Tennis Relive going back in the past, and it's been really interesting to look back at the start of Venus's career a lot more than I ever had done, just to see what a personality she was, what a force she was. And I think, obviously, with her syndrome, she's faded in the second half of her career. She's been massively overtaken in terms of Grand Slam achievements by Serena, and I think it's easy to just overlook how great she was and is. And I think a slam in 2017 would have really brought that back into focus for a lot of people.
The US Open a couple of days ago tweeted out a short sort of 2-3 minute highlights reel of a match that Venus Williams played against Justine Henin at the 2007 US Open. And I think I probably watched that match at the time. I've got the vaguest residual memory of it. My breath was taken by the quality of the hitting, the depth and power on the shots on both sides. It's mind blowing tennis, and to see Venus Williams in full flow like that against a great adversary, I'm already salivating at the prospect of watching that match back. P.S. I would still quite like the US Open to happen.
Assuming
it doesn't,
we're going to have it anyway, right? We're going to relive that match anyway, even if it happens, the US Open. We'll have it in the run-up. So there we go. There's another extra podcast for us to do.
Great.
Fantastic. We haven't got enough of them. So, you know. Yeah. Oh, great days. We can't we can't change any results.
The
though,
past.
Can we?
It's all we've got.
Right.
Next.
What else? We've got through three questions. We've got about 10 minutes left.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
R-Monk2 on Twitter. Which players have made the most transformative coaching appointments in terms of their subsequent results, both positive and negative impacts?
Well, Ivan Lendl, I think, for Andy Murray. You know, the data speaks for itself, doesn't he? He was missing the final 2%. He was missing just the very pointy bits of his fangs. Lendl comes on board and suddenly... I'm coming to that, David.
Carry on.
No, well, you've spoiled it now. You go.
No, carry on.
Well, no, I mean, the point made. Comes on board twice, wins slams, done. Over to you.
Meanwhile, I would go for Magnus Norman, who not only did it with Robin Söderling, admittedly didn't win a slam, but he got to two slam finals, beat Nadal, which nobody had ever done, and turned Söderling into the best that he could be, I thought, and then turned Stan Wawrinka into a Grand Slam champion, albeit not on his own. I mean, you know, you've got to have the raw materials, but I don't think anybody's sort of shaped and polished raw materials in recent years quite like Magnus Norman has.
Darren Cahill and Simona Halep probably deserves a mention. I know it's not quite the linear ascent. You know, they had some wobbles and ups and downs, but would Halep have got there without that journey she went on with Darren Cahill? I don't know. He was certainly a big part of finally making her a Grand Slam champion. And the other one I would say that the data very much supports is Marion Vida. as soon as Djokovic, I mean, I know it's kind of chicken and egg cause and effect, but as soon as Djokovic ditched Marion Vida, suddenly he's going through that really, really fallow period that we talked about on the Worst of the Greats pod, and brings him back into his team, and all's right with the world again. You know, they are... can't do it without him.
I'd also make a point for Anibal Medina Garrigues, who have I said that correctly? Who coached Yelena Ostapenko, and she won the French Open, and always felt like she was the one who got the very best out of her. And Conchita Martinez, who helped Garbiñe Muguruza to win Wimbledon.
I would make a case for Carlos Moya being a great addition to Rafa Nadal's team. I think, again, we discussed that barren run that Nadal went on our Worst of the Big Three, 2015, 2016. Then Moya came in and Nadal was kind of regenerated. And I think the reason I like that coaching appointment is because Nadal had always been with Uncle Tony. And it just, I don't know why we always call him Uncle Tony. It's just not my uncle.
I saw you flinch a bit as you said it, but what else are you supposed to say? If you say Tony, everyone would be like, Tony who?
Yeah.
I once requested an interview to Nadal's PR person. Could I speak to Uncle Tony, please? Because he just burst out laughing.
But I just think it showed a willingness there to adapt and not be stubborn. And I think that was an incredible decision, because Moya has certainly added... Well, again, I suppose it's kind of that cause and effect. I think Nadal has become a more complete player in these last 2 or 3 years. And whether that's down to Moya or not, who can say? But certainly it has coincided. I think he's certainly been more aggressive, and that's probably Moya deserves a tip of the hat there. I think also the one that always interests me is how Angelique Kerber went from kind of a Stan Wawrinka-like career trajectory, really, in terms of great player and then suddenly a Grand Slam champion. I wouldn't necessarily put it completely down to a coaching appointment, but I do know that she got rid of Torben Belt and then went back to him and then had the 2016 season. I think that also shows good judgment. I'm trying not to say Murray and Lendl, but of knowing when to go back.
Even when no one could possibly predict that would happen.
Exactly. Mm. What about some of the worst?
Jimmy Connors, Maria Sharapova.
Yeah. Thomas Muster and Dominic Thiem.
Thomas Muster and Dominic Thiem.
I mean, Todd
Connors, Martin.
Sharapova lasted one match, didn't it?
Yeah. Todd Martin, Novak Djokovic, as referenced.
Juan Carlos Ferrero.
Zverev.
I think any coaching partnership that ends in a fight.
You might think
good.
That these would have been more successful than they were, and you'd have to say Lendl and Zverev. Okay, they had the ATP Finals win, which I guess is the culmination of his career so far, but for it to not last, it didn't work.
Agassi and Djokovic didn't end well, did it? Ended in a bit of a spat.
I'd also, just on the positive side, just point to one that isn't one of these knee-jerk make-a-difference types, but Tony Pickard and Stefan Edberg. We had an interview with Stefan Edberg last week, which we'll have for you as well in the coming weeks. And he was with Tony Pickard his entire career. But he basically coached and fathered him in many ways into a champion when he was a really shy and quiet and uncombative type character, and brought out the devil in him so that he could at least compete. He was not confrontational at all, and Tony got the best out of him by gradually working with him and just helping him understand that side of the game. And I find that really interesting as a way of, you know, the answer these days is, oh, not going well, change the coach. Mm. Well, maybe it doesn't have to be like that. And that's why I quite like the fact that you brought up Marion Vider and Tony Nadal and people like that have just been there all along.
Mm.
I think Severin Luthi would probably be another one, the kind of stability in Federer's camp throughout the years. Couple more questions?
Quickies.
Go for it.
Okay, let's start with the one that we teased at the start then. If you each had entrance music like a boxer coming out for a fight, what song would you choose? This is from Roberto Grammar on Instagram.
I am the one and only Chesney Hawk. Obviously.
I'd have
really?
To sing.
I mean, I am the one and only. It's just factual. There's no other one of me, is there?
Okay.
Doesn't mean it's good.
I'd have the Succession theme tune.
Oh. Why?
It's just great, isn't it? It's dramatic.
Mm.
It's got some swagger. I think it would inspire me. It's just it's got attitude.
I'd have Don't Worry, Be Happy.
Oh, God.
And the Rocky music.
What? As a mashup?
A mashup.
Yeah. Actually, no, I'd have the Liquidator from the Albion. From West Bromwich Albion, they have the Liquidator playing out when they come out. So I'll have that. Particularly because there's some words in it where you tell Wolverhampton Wanderers fans to go away, let's say.
What are you having, Matt?
Badlands. Yeah. I want to go out tonight, find out what I got. Feels like an appropriate message. I may win, I may lose, but I'll be out there. And it's punchy and loud.
And not cringe.
And not Chesney Hawk.
I'll have Always Look on the Bright Side of Life.
Oh, that's what that's the most played song at funerals.
Well, what can I say? Which seems a bit contradictory, really, to me. But anyway. Okay. What else we got?
Okay, we have a question from Matt Ranter on Instagram, who says, with matchups like Serena versus Federer at the Hopman Cup and Serena and Murray teaming up at Wimbledon, as well as more recent discussions of tour mergers, do you think more should be done to encourage mixed doubles at tournaments? What do you think this could look like? And then he says, the year-end finals always feels a bit anticlimactic in the wider context of the season. Do you think it would be viable to merge the men's and women's events and create a pool of mixed teams from the top eight players?
I'd love to see it, that second point. I don't see it ever happening, the merging the two end-of-year finals, because they are each individually for the ATP and WTA, the most significant moneymakers for them. They completely rely on them financially. I know those two events are the main goals at the moment for the ATP and WTA, just trying to find a way for them to happen, because if they don't, then both organisations will be pretty crippled financially. So unless you can find a way to combine them and preserve the profits that they currently generate, which maybe that's possible, but unless that were possible, I don't see that happening, unfortunately, although I would love to see it. Mixed doubles at events? Yeah, bring it on. Absolutely bring it on. It's a no-brainer. How many times can we say it? Tennis is at its best when it's exploiting its USP. Which
here's one for you. If you could completely rip it up and start again now, given the situation we're in, and say, okay, men and women merging, and you play your individual singles events, but then every tournament has to have doubles, and every tournament has to have mixed doubles, and everybody has to play, and it's a ranking that reflects that, and those are the rules, and yes, less attention will end up being paid to singles, and you may not be at your absolute peak for singles anymore because you're having to put so much extra work into it all. But a little bit like the Davis Cup and all the Fed Cup and the way that's given some significance to doubles, that you have to play it, and therefore it becomes important and relevant. You did that at Grand Slams. Would you do it if you had the chance?
Of course, but that doesn't mean it would necessarily work as intended. I mean, look at the blue clay and the power that Djokovic and Nadal ended up wielding on that concept and getting rid of it. And you might end up with a lot of tanked matches if players are forced to play sort of against their will.
I'm just thinking, if you had a commissioner of tennis and you had one person who made the rules and they came in and said, no, this is what tennis is now, and those top players had signed on the dotted line to say, yes, this is the commissioner of tennis that we want, and that person, and we're going to elect them, and therefore we will back their judgment, and this is what they want. Would you be in favour of it? Do you think it would be worth it?
Mandatory doubles and mixed doubles for every player at every event.
Selected number of events that can contribute to your ranking or whatever.
I'm saying no. I think the point of a merger shouldn't be more mixed doubles. I love mixed doubles. I want more mixed doubles. But the point of a merger should be more power in the market generally, equality across the board, and tennis should be about men and women sharing the same stage, not necessarily sharing the same court all the time. I think I like mixed doubles. I think it has a place. I'd like to see more of it, but I think tennis should still be an individual sport primarily, and I think it should be based mainly
doubles
on your.
Brilliant. We love doubles. Why do you want to be sidelined?
I'm not.
But why do you want doubles to be sidelined? Why is singles sidelined in any way because of doubles gaining more prominence?
Well, it just would be, as you were saying, it would be a combined ranking, so that would knock singles. I think singles, personally, you know, it's just my opinion, I think it is not necessarily like the higher form of the game, but it's the form of the game that I think is more interesting year round. I think I prefer to follow a singles player year round. It's a greater test of what makes tennis tennis. I think that individual duel out on the court between two people. And I think doubles has a big part to play in tennis. But I like the current system of some people playing doubles, some people playing singles. And I like having events like team events, which push doubles more. But I think ultimately singles should be the priority, and getting men's and women's singles on the on an equal footing all around would be the biggest benefit of a merger, I think.
What do you think, Catherine?
I think incentivizing players to play more doubles, yes. I don't think that's any bad thing. I think doubles is in a sticky spot at the moment, and I'd like to see it in a better place. But I think mandatory doubles and mixed doubles, I'm not sure that's the way to go. And if it were, then only at a, you know, say five events throughout the year or whatever. But I don't think sort of mandatory at the majority of events is necessarily the thing. But recognizing that there's a place for it, I don't think sort of, as Matt says, trying to engineer it to be on a level footing is necessarily the way forward. But recognizing the place for it and trying to make the best of that place,
just feel like
is,
we've been
is a good
doing
thing.
That for so many
have we,
years.
Who's,
and
how
nowhere.
Have people been trying
well,
to
when
do
I was
that?
At the ATP, the AT, and this is 20 years ago, the ATP hired doubles manager and promoter with the sole objective of making doubles more popular. We've seen lots of marketing attempts and players playing clinics and that sort of things, offering up the time, and I respect them for it. They've made some efforts, and you often see when, oh, somebody needs to be doing the autograph signings, let's send the doubles players, let's send them to do those interviews so that we don't have to ask the singles players. I understand all that. I just would love to see the day like when Martin Navratilova was world number one and John McEnroe was world number one, and they played doubles and they valued doubles, and it was just as big a deal to them as the singles, and it was up in lights that much more as a result of it. I would love to see those days return. Now, I just don't think unless you make systematic change, unless you actually do something about it, it's not going to happen because it's not in the public eye.
Yeah. I mean, there are two situations in which doubles becomes really relevant and of interest, and those are when top names play and in team competitions.
Where you have to play it. And that's what I'm arguing for. Now, I accept maybe it's at a certain number of events, but I would love to see it just, yeah.
But, I mean, they don't,
put front and
they,
center.
They don't have to play it at team competitions.
If they want their team to win, Andy Murray plays in the doubles, doesn't he? When push comes to shove, when it becomes really important, win the tie or don't win the tie, he gets picked over Johnny Murray, he got picked over Dom Inglot, it was him and Jamie Murray.
Unless he's got a mysterious injury / put on some kilos.
But, you know, that's the point, is that doubles is part of the end result of that competition. And therefore, Andy Murray couldn't afford not to play.
Yeah, so I would rather see more competitions like that.
There are other examples where, you know, you'd play Hébert Mahut over the two top-ranked singles players. There are counterexamples to that.
No, I agree with you. But I feel like if you don't have any actual reason for the top players to play, I mean, money's not going to do it. They're loaded. Just for the good of the doubles game, that ain't going to do it. I don't see what encouragement there can possibly be other than making them and having a real reason for it as part of the competition.
I just think those days of playing as many singles and doubles matches as the likes of McEnroe and Navratilova did, I mean, they're just not going to come back. It's just not.
They could if you wanted them to. They could. If you decided that tennis would
the point is that the top players would say no. And then it's just a non-starter.
David is very much of the where there's a will, there's a way mentality.
Look at the situation we're in right now. Who would have thought that tennis wouldn't exist for 6 months? and that's the situation. Who would have thought Wimbledon wouldn't get played?
So therefore, anything is possible. There's no point in debating it or having an opinion.
You can have an opinion on whether you want to do it or not. And I'm sure that what I'm saying is if enough people decided we need to have faith in a commissioner the way that basketball and NFL do, for instance, so that when there's a really good idea, it doesn't get held up by what might be suitable for the top players. We heard Janko Tipsarevic talking about blue clay. Once the top players decided, that was the end of it. Well, maybe that wasn't for the best of the game. That was for the good of
sure,
Nadal
but now
and Djokovic.
You're talking about the restructuring of all of you're talking about a world in which the whole of tennis has been restructured, which is kind of a different debate.
But why would we say, oh yeah, but that'll never happen, so therefore don't want that to happen? Maybe you don't want that to happen, but
because
I don't see why we would limit ourselves if we're saying tennis, as we know, it has just ended.
But why? Because I think that's overly optimistic.
And why did it stop happening?
Well, I mean, a variety of reasons. I think money in singles. A few stop and they start winning Grand Slam singles titles. Bjorn Borg didn't play. And eventually, I think players end up deciding, well, actually, I don't want to play doubles because I need to save my energy. But if everybody was doing it, you're all in the same boat.
But would we be looking then at players having shorter careers because they're playing more doubles than they are singles? All these things would be a trade-off. And I think the sort of current system where singles is the priority for the best players, personally, I think that's the best one. And I think I like the way doubles is elevated at certain events. But I wouldn't want to see doubles elevated to sacrifice the way, like the strong position that singles is in currently.
If Federer deployed more of his canister on doubles throughout his career, he might already be retired now, and we'd be missing out on years of Federer. We don't know, but Matt's right. There are trade-offs that.
When you hear Martina and John McEnroe talk, they say they preferred playing doubles than practicing, and they used doubles as a way to just
practicing.
Keep their eye on. Well, he messes around in practice a lot, and he loves, you know.
The sport is a lot more physical and technical now. There's a lot more that goes into practicing, you know, gym work. And
before this period we're in now, most people were saying we need less tennis. Like, I think this is like the sort of karmic result of those conversations, and I won't be having them again. But
perhaps if you had doubles, you would have a different type of tennis. You would have more understanding of touch. Maybe matches would be less grueling. Maybe,
but I'm not sure that's just about
less.
Doubles. I think that's about court surface and all string technology. And
would you sacrifice best of five at slams, David, for your doubles plan?
I'd consider it.
Wow.
Really?
I'd consider it.
Wow.
I'd consider it. The thing is, I feel, having had time to not have the everyday of tennis, where you feel as though you are straitjacketed into this is how it is, work within that structure. I feel like, why not I reimagine the game right now? Maybe we're going to have to reimagine lots of things within the game. So why not throw this into the mix just to see whether that's something that should be brought in for the greater good of it long term? We're just so used to what it has always been. And yes, it has provided some wonderful stuff, but we have lost doubles in terms of its profile. The fact that we were covering the WTA finals for years on BT Sport and only covering the singles bothers me. And I loved working for BT Sport, but that bothered me. And I feel like that part of obviously that's on them to a large degree, but it's also on the sport making it. If the top players were playing, it'd be covered.
But as much as there's lots of what you're saying that I really agree with, but are we glorifying a bit what doubles was in the past? No doubt it was bigger and more elevated and there was more attention on it because the top players played. But Okay, so how many matches have we relived and put on our list to relive over the next coming weeks? So we've got 15 matches at the French, 14 at Wimbledon, 13 at Wimbledon. We've done Miami, Madrid, we're doing Rome this weekend. No one's even mentioned doing a doubles match from the 80s or whatever.
If we were to do Davis Cup, I dare say doubles would feature pretty prominently.
Yeah, but that's what we're saying. That's its place.
But I'm saying, why limit yourself to just Davis Cup? Why not make it a bigger thing? Because when you look at those Davis Cup ties, that's the bit that's the best a lot of the time. So why would you not make more of it?
Because you can't. That's like saying, why not have a Grand Slam every week? So that because it needs, it's elevated because of the shortness of supply.
The status quo isn't the status quo because necessarily it is how it is at its best. It's kind of how it's ended up falling.
But I also think when I've been to Davis and Fed Cup rubbers, the whole atmosphere of Davis and Fed Cup suits doubles. It's a staccato rhythm, and there's a way that fans support at those events where they will cheer even after like a really boring point, and that will elevate the match itself. I think doubles takes on an extra significance at Davis and Fed Cup because of the way the crowds are. Personally, I think that's been my experience of being in the stadium. And I just don't think you can compare.
Crowds aren't a thing anymore, Matt.
I don't think you can compare Davis Cup to tour tennis.
Okay, well, you could compare winning singles gold versus doubles gold at the Olympics, couldn't you? And I don't think your singles gold means any more to the individual than your doubles gold.
Oh, I'm wow. Sure I think that's a that. Really big sweeping statement.
I genuinely believe that. I think, but again,
you can't compare.
No, I don't think that's
winning
true.
Winning a gold
Davis.
Medal compared to winning on the tour, that is different.
I don't think that's true, David.
Whenever people say to Federer, "You've never won gold at the Olympics," he says, "I have."
Yeah, of course, and you'd expect him to be chippy about people. That's not the same as. Come on, that's not the same.
It'd be interesting to ask a player who's won both. Let's get Nicolas Massou on. He's done both, hasn't he?
Yeah.
You know, let's find out. I mean,
Serena's done both.
I may be wrong. I may be wrong, but that my sense is that at the Olympics, a gold medal is a gold medal. I don't feel that tennis makes enough of doubles anywhere close.
But that is also on us. Like, you know, we're working at slams, and if we wanted to cover doubles more, we could, but we don't. Why don't we? Because we prefer singles.
Part of it
right?
is because it's just shunted to the sidelines.
Well,
and we're told it doesn't mean as much because look at the prize money, look at the court assignments, look at the TV coverage. You know, if tennis decided doubles was important. And really showed that by the weight that it puts behind it, then...
Okay, well, then the ATP finals, when you've got the sessions with both. You know, we've been at the ATP finals covering that event, and, you know, maybe this is kind of shame on us, but we've been having lunch during the doubles and watching the singles.
And I totally hold my hand up to that, but I would also say that if... the rankings were combined, and if all players had to play both disciplines, you would get players in that doubles the same way as you would in the singles that played both. And therefore, everybody's singing from the same sheet then. They're all saying that doubles is a big deal. At the moment, it's an afterthought, and it's reflected in the way we cover it. And I admit to being part of the problem. I just wonder whether maybe the whole thing should be reimagined. Let us know what you think at Tennis Podcast. It's an interesting discussion.
Yeah,
I'm up for reimagining and for there being a commissioner.
Sure.
And a lot of what you say, I just think you're reimagining a lot. I just think you're going a bit far. I think we're sort of on the same page up to a point. But you're just imagining a sort of doubles utopia.
Right. So there we are. Another questions and answers session done and dusted. We got through it. And
not unscathed, but we got through.
Not unscathed,
might not be speaking again for a while.
Might have to have a bit of time to ourselves for a bit. Have we got any shout outs, Matt?
Yes, we do. To Jay Jayana.
Thank you, Jay.
Thank you,
to
Jay.
Chris Loomis.
Cheers, Chris.
Thanks, Chris. Hey.
And to Paula Rory.
Oh, Paula.
Hey, Paula.
All of those three people have backed the tennis podcast. And that means the cumulative, not just the one that they happen to be on the side of whenever we get rowing. So
isn't there
thank you.
Isn't there a song called Hey Paula?
That I don't
hey,
know.
Hey Paula. That.
David probably wants it as his entrance music.
If you can get a version with David.
I've thought of another song to play at Change Events with no crowds. I think we're alone now.
She's flying.
Yeah.
She's flying, Catherine Whittaker.
Found something to do with my day. Hooray.
Thank you to all three of you and everybody else who backed the tennis podcast at the end of last year when you thought you were going to have weeklies throughout the year and dailies at every Grand Slam. And you're getting that. Plus, you're getting twice weeklies. It's just that we haven't got any real tennis to talk about that's happening now. So we're doing different things. We're reliving tennis. We're reimagining tennis. We're talking about the rules. And we're going to be daily throughout Roland Garros, the original dates, and Wimbledon. We've already done loads of interviews to talk to players who were significant in all the matches that we are going to be covering. We'll release all of those to you in the next week or so, so you can, you know what's coming up. But we've had the best time, really, talking to some great names from the past, great coaches of those players from those points in time, watching old matches. It's really been fun, and we're going to do the same again on Monday, where we relive two great moments from Rome, because that's what would have been happening right this week. We're going to go back to the early 90s when Gabriella Sabatini was absolutely dominant in Rome. She won four titles in 5 years, including beating Monica Seles, peak Monica Seles, 2 years in succession. I was watching all of those matches at about 6 a.m. today, and that was great. And we're going to go back to 2006, which probably, Catherine and Matt, I think if 2008 Wimbledon final hadn't happened, we'd probably be talking about that as one of the greatest matches of all time, wouldn't we? And we're going to be covering Federer, Nadal, Rome, 2006.
Mm. There was aggro in it, which is one thing the 2008 Wimbledon final didn't have. Yes, if I'm remembering right, Federer accused Uncle Tony of doing some Mouratoglou-style courtside coaching.
Oh, brilliant. You know, I never watched this match. I never got a chance to
really?
See it. So,
oh, you're in for a treat, David.
This is going to be my first experience. So we're going to watch it this weekend. So if you can get a chance to watch it yourselves, it'll be on Tennis TV. I'm sure it's out there somewhere else as
well. I should say that you might need to plan your whole weekend around it, because it is about 5 hours.
Yeah, I'm going to be setting my alarm clock for 4 to get enough time to watch it. And
you'll be on your own.
Gabriella Sabatini, 1992 is the year that we're focusing on. But I mean, we'll be talking about her whole career at the Italian Open in particular, because she had such success there and never actually managed to win the French Open, although she had great results there. But lots to get our teeth into over the next weeks and months to come. Thank you, Catherine and Matt. Thank you all for listening. Review us on iTunes if you've enjoyed the show, and if you've enjoyed our other editions, it all helps to tell people about us and hopefully get more people listening along. We have our Reddit page, which you can get involved in and chat with fellow listeners and tennis fans, which is you can access via our show notes. We've got our newsletter, which will be going out in a couple of days' time, and will include Matt's weekly stat and our isolation diaries, where we'll tell you what we've been doing with our time, aside from talking to you a lot on the podcast. And get yourself on the newsletter, show notes again to click on and sign up. That's free. And just tell everybody you know, if you wouldn't mind, about the tennis podcast, so we get as many listeners as we can that can witness Catherine and me arguing. See you next week.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands.
They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sports-ad-free. That's amazon.com/sports-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.